Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're jumping straight into the Q4 FY25 quarterly report. Our goal here is to give you the high-level insights, the really crucial stuff for anyone in superannuation and wealth management. We've picked out five key articles, and we're going to unpack the main takeaways for you. Cut through the noise, basically.
Absolutely. And what's really interesting is how these topics, which might seem separate, actually weave together. You start to see this bigger picture of the challenges, but also the real opportunities in the industry right now. We'll cover everything from tech foundations right through to member engagement. It's all connected.
Okay, let's get into it. First up, we're picking up on something from the Q3 report, that idea of underdeveloped operational infrastructure. This quarter's article has a great title: Legacy Technology. Houston, we might not have a problem. Kind of grabs you, doesn't it?
It does. It immediately makes you think.
Yeah, they use a fantastic analogy of the Space Shuttle Atlantis. Flew its last mission in 2011, but guess what? Its core IT systems were from the early 70s. Incredible.
It's a brilliant comparison. And the report defines legacy tech carefully. It's not just old, it's mission-critical stuff built with outdated tech. Think lack of modern features, tricky interoperability, inflexible architecture. And in super, our registry systems, the core platforms tracking member accounts, contributions, balances, they often fit this bill perfectly. Many are 20-plus years old.
But the point is, like NASA, funds often have good reasons for sticking with these systems, right? It's not just inertia. I like that quote from Jarni Straastrup, the C++ inventor. Legacy code often differs from its suggested alternative by actually working and scaling.
Exactly. There's proven reliability there. These systems have handled complexity for decades.
But it's not all smooth sailing, obviously. What are the main headaches these systems cause?
Well, the user experience is a big one. They often just can't deliver that slick, modern feel members and staff expect now. And trying to just sort of wrap them with a new front end, that's really hard because they weren't designed for those kinds of integrations.
Right. The plumbing underneath wasn't meant for it.
Precisely. Then there's the cost of change. Finding people with the skills for these older systems is getting tougher and tougher, expensive, and scalability, especially if you're still on mainframes versus, say, the cloud, that's a constant challenge.
So given all that, what's the core advice here? How should funds approach this? Is it always about replacing them?
No, and that's the key takeaway, I think. The report argues legacy tech can be an asset if managed smartly. It highlights 4 points. First, legacy technology as an asset. Think about NASA's MAVEN mission in 2013. They reused old hardware and software, saved a ton of time and money. For super funds, it means using that proven registry system for what it was designed for, maybe complex defined benefit schemes, not forcing it into new roles. Leverage its strengths.
Okay, so use it for its original purpose. That makes sense. What's next?
Second is having a clearly defined role. This contrasts with failures like the Mars Observer mission, where they pushed legacy parts way too far. For us, that means resisting the urge to heavily modify, say, a core registry system to handle real-time insurance admin. That wasn't its job. Need discipline there.
Discipline. Got it. So keep it in its lane. And assuming you do that, you still need to maintain it, right? Especially for the long haul.
Absolutely. Point three is continuous improvement. Look at the space shuttles, tech, 70s stuff. But their past team focused relentlessly on improving it, eliminating defects. That led to an amazing safety record. For funds, this means you can't just let legacy systems sit there. You need ongoing investment in performance, stability, usability, especially now with regulators watching service levels so closely.
And the skills gap you mentioned, how do you tackle that?
That's a fourth point.
Yeah.
Training and knowledge management. The talent pool is shrinking. So the report suggests things like internal academies to train people up and really robust knowledge management, detailed documentation, solid onboarding to capture that expertise before it, walks out the door.
Okay, really practical advice there on managing the old stuff. But let's pivot now. From legacy tech to the new frontier everyone's buzzing about, AI.
Right.
Artificial intelligence. It definitely feels different this time, doesn't it? More transformative than past hype cycles. But here's the kicker from the report. AI's huge promise: efficiency, optimization, better service. It all hinges on something much less flashy: solid data foundations.
Yeah.
Without good data governance, understanding your end-to-end processes, having effective controls, knowing the difference between data integrity and operational data quality, it falls apart. And you need data literacy across the organization. You know the saying, rubbish in, rubbish out. It's never been truer than with AI.
Yeah, the report hits hard on this. It quotes Gartner predicting 80% of AI projects will fail by 2027 because of poor data quality. 80%. That's a wake-up call for the industry, isn't it? All this investment in shiny AI, but maybe underinvesting in the boring foundational stuff.
Exactly. The report calls this the hidden tension. You've got the offensive data strategy, innovation, analytics, AI. That's exciting, easy to get funding for. Then you have the defensive side, data quality, governance, literacy, risk management, often seen as just overhead, a compliance chore. But they're not separate things.
Not at all. They're two sides of the same coin. The report uses a great sports analogy. Offense wins games, but defense wins championships. You can't really leverage the exciting offensive stuff, the AI, the analytics, without a strong defensive foundation protecting you from errors, risks, bad decisions. They reinforce each other.
So how do we fix this perception? How do you convince people that data quality isn't just a cost, but actually a strategic asset? What are the upsides?
The benefits are really tangible when you lay them out. Less money spent fixing mistakes, lower operational risk, lower reputational risk too. You build stronger trust with clients, you make decisions with more confidence, and crucially, your AI projects are far more likely to succeed. Plus, you get better at using your operational data for meeting regulatory requirements. It's not just about AI, it's about running the business better, full stop.
So it's like a cycle. Good governance enables AI, and AI then shows you where you need better data.
Precisely. It's a cyclical journey, not a linear path. Strong governance allies innovation, and that innovation shines a light on new data optimization opportunities. The big push towards AI is actually a fantastic opportunity to finally tackle those long-standing data management issues that maybe got ignored before.
The article title is Release the Handbrake. For someone listening, what's a quick sign that the handbrake is still firmly on in their organization?
Oh, easy. If you see teams constantly creating manual data workarounds, if people argue about who owns which data set, or if your AI projects keep getting bogged down in that data cleaning phase and never seem to deliver, those are big red flags. Releasing the handbrake means you trust your data, you have a joined up strategy, and you've got solid controls right across the data supply chain. Confidence, basically.
Okay, so data is the foundation. Now, let's talk speed, another big pressure point. Everyone seems to want real time, but what does that actually mean in our world?
Yeah, real time gets thrown around a lot, and the report points out the ambiguity. In pure engineering, it means the system's correctness depends on the speed it delivers the result. Very strict. But in finance, we often use it more loosely. It might mean just pretty quick, or up-to-date data, or simply not waiting for the overnight batch run.
And that confusion matters.
It really does. Because if you don't clarify what's actually needed, you might build a super complex, expensive, true real-time system when something simpler would have worked. True real-time is hard. Hard to build, hard to integrate, hard to monitor and maintain properly.
So the report warns against just jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah.
Maybe driven by a bit of FOMO, fear of missing out.
Definitely. It urges you to probe deeper. When someone asks for real time, what's the underlying functional need?
Like what? What might they actually mean?
Well, they might just want immediate feedback so the user feels confident something happened. Or they need current data. Maybe data from the last hour is fine, not the last microsecond. Or it could be about fast response generally, or needing live updates pushed out as notifications, or even ensuring distributed consistency across microservices. Understanding that real need often points you to simpler, cheaper solutions than full-blown, high-cost real-time.
So when is it justified? How do you make the business case for that significant investment in complexity?
The report suggests three key assessments. First, what's the actual business impact of a delay? If a delay means serious financial loss, regulatory failure, or big risks, think fraud prevention needing to stop a payment before it goes, or high-frequency trading where milliseconds count, then okay, real-time might be essential.
So measurable harm from delay.
Exactly. Second, can those delays, if they exist, be tolerated or mitigated some other way? Is there a workaround? And third, critically, does your organization have the technical capability and operational maturity to actually support these demanding systems? They need constant care and feeding monitoring, testing, maintenance. It's a big commitment.
You mentioned fraud, trading.
Mm.
Any other clear examples where it's usually necessary?
Regulatory monitoring often requires near immediate reporting. And instant payments, like using the MPP or PayEye here in Australia, obviously need that near-instant finality. Delays there cause real problems for people.
Okay, but what if you don't need it everywhere? The report talks about hybrid architecture and intelligent avoidance. Tell me about intelligent avoidance. Sounds clever.
It is clever. It's about delivering that feeling of responsiveness without the underlying real-time complexity. One technique is optimistic updates. You update the user interface immediately to show a change, like confirming an address update instantly, even if the back-end system is still processing it, gives instant gratification.
Ah, I see. Like on websites sometimes.
Yeah. Another is progressive enhancement. Breaking down a long process into visible steps with feedback. Think of an insurance, quote, calculation, showing you progress bars or intermediate results. Keeps the user engaged. And then there's intelligent caching and prefetching. Showing slightly older cache data instantly while refreshing in the background, or offering an update now button. Tiered freshness, basically.
So lots of ways to be smart about it. It's not all or nothing.
Precisely. It's about when and how to use real-time strategically, balancing the value against the cost and the risk, not just defaulting to it.
Right. We've dug into Tech Foundation's data speed.
Yeah.
But it's easy to get lost in the mechanics, isn't it?
This next article, really brings us back to the core purpose. Why does this industry even exist? Yeah, it's a powerful reminder. Amidst all the operational complexities, investment strategies, regulatory pressures, it's easy to lose sight of the fundamental goal, preserving savings for identified retirement for members. The report argues really strongly that every single dollar spent OPEX or CAPEX needs to be clearly traceable back to that objective. And not in some vague, hand-wavy way, but using SMART criteria. Specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and time-bound.
It demands what the report calls ruthless clarity, asking tough questions. Why this spend? How exactly does it improve retirement outcomes? When will we see the benefit? Can we prove it?
It's a mindset shift. Instead of starting with, how do we justify spending this money, the question becomes, if we didn't do this, how would it negatively impact a member's ability to retire with dignity? That flips the perspective entirely. Member outcomes become the non-negotiable driver.
And the SMART framework is the tool to make that real, not just a nice idea. How does that work in practice? Give us an example.
Okay, so, specific. Maybe the goal is reducing admin fees for members or increasing their investment returns by a certain amount. Very concrete. Measurable. How will you track it? Okay, we aim for a fee reduction of, say, 5 basis points, or a measurable uplift in member engagement scores related to retirement planning.
Got it. Tangible numbers.
Exactly. Achievable. Is this actually feasible with the resources we have, the timelines, the member engagement we expect? Be realistic, relevant. Does this initiative directly connect to improving retirement income or ensuring fairness and equity for members? And time-bound. By when will the member actually feel this benefit? Setting a deadline. It forces accountability.
And the report connects this framework back to those tech and data initiatives we were just talking about, particularly AI and automation.
Yes, it gives concrete examples of how you apply the smart thinking to tech investments to ensure they deliver real member value.
Such.
Well, one is using an NLP-enabled virtual assistant, natural language processing. The SMART goal isn't just implement a chatbot. It's reduce call center costs traceable to specific query types by X percent within 12 months, freeing up Y dollars per member by deploying a virtual assistant that can understand intent and execute low-risk tasks like reissuing statements. See the difference.
Much sharper. Much more focused on the member outcome, lower costs, potentially better service.
Exactly. Another example, AI for automating high-volume transactions. The goal isn't just automation for its own sake. It's reduce operational admin costs and processing contributions by Z percent through AI-driven validation, leading to fewer errors and faster crediting of member accounts, demonstrably improving data quality metrics by Q3 FAR.
So it forces you to quantify the why in member terms.
Absolutely. Other examples include using AI for predictive member retention analytics, identifying at-risk members and nudging them digitally, or for enhanced fraud prevention. All framed with SMART, member-centric goals. The underlying message is profound. Recommit to the core purpose. Treat every dollar like it's the member's own money, because it is. And show how you're making it work harder for their retirement.
Which leads perfectly into our final article, Getting Retirement Incomes Right for Real People, bringing it all home to the ultimate outcome. The report argues that while products like account-based pensions, ABPs, and annuities are great tools, just relying on SMART default isn't enough anymore. Especially once members hit retirement.
That's a key point. The SMART default system has been incredibly successful in the accumulation phase, putting investment choices in professional hands, saved many people from making poor decisions. But the weakness is, when that default safety net disappears at retirement, members often don't know what to do next. They're suddenly driving the bus. And the report suggests a lot of the industry talk focuses too much on abstract ideas, what retirement looks like, how much is enough, rather than understanding where members actually are on their financial maturity journey.
So how do we bridge that gap? The retirement income covenant obviously plays a huge role here, doesn't it?
It's central. The covenant forces trustees to develop a retirement income strategy. That strategy has to cover member understanding product design and marketing, yes, but critically. It requires using data to understand if members are actually progressing towards a good retirement outcome or if they're falling behind, measuring that financial maturity curve.
And the report gets quite technical on how a trustee could actually do that, build the capability.
It does. It outlines a four-step approach. First, attribute mapping. Define quantifiable proxies for a good retirement. Things like hitting certain balance thresholds by age, maybe health indicators, housing security, things you can measure.
Okay, define what good looks like in data terms.
Then, data infrastructure. Build the systems to actually track members against these attributes over time, looking at different cohorts and behaviors. Scalable data stores are key. Third, insight translation. Use that data to develop smart segmentation. Understand the gaps in different member pathways. Then create behavioral nudges, tailored messages, or interventions to help close those gaps. And finally, channel deployment. Deliver the right advice or nudge through the right channel for that member or cohort. Digital, phone, face-to-face, meet them where they are.
That sounds like a lot for individual trustees to build. The report also floats the idea of industry collaboration, right? A joint marketing campaign.
Yes, and I think that's a powerful idea. Imagine regulators and industry bodies working together on a campaign. It could really highlight the clear advantages of products like ABPs, the tax benefits, the flexibility, the investment potential, make it less intimidating.
How else could that work?
Share real member stories, maybe alongside simple dashboards showing projected income streams and how assets might deplete under different scenarios. Make it tangible. And importantly, explain concepts like longevity pooling, how everyone contributing helps protect those who live longer. Frame it ethically as a form of shared security. That could really resonate.
So the potential is there, combining the efficiency of products like ADPs with the accountability from the covenant and these new data capabilities.
Exactly. The report sees Australia's system as really well positioned for more advanced modeling, much greater transparency, and genuine long-term sustainability. But the technical challenge for trustees is clear. You have to translate those high-level goals, better retirement incomes, fairness into concrete, quantitative actions across your products, your member engagement, and how you ensure equity.
So quite a journey we've taken there, from wrestling with legacy technology to harnessing data for AI, figuring out what real time really means, and grounding it all back in that core principle of member centricity, all aiming for better retirement outcomes. These articles from the Q4 FY25 report, they're not just separate pieces, are they? They really are interconnected pillars for where the industry needs to go.
They absolutely are. And if you pull back and look at the big picture connecting all these themes, it seems the future isn't about trying to avoid complexity altogether. It's about strategically embracing complexity, where it genuinely adds value for the member, whether that's sophisticated data analysis, targeted engagement, or carefully managed technology. Which leaves a really interesting question for you listening to think about. How is your organization going to bring these threads together? The tech, the data, the fundamental purpose to make sure every decision, every dollar spent, genuinely helps real people retire with more confidence, fairness, and dignity.
A powerful question to end on. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the Q4 FY25 quarterly report. We hope these insights spark some valuable conversations and actions.